Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. Throughout January 2022, a potpourri of delicious guests are taking a jaunty stroll through Peter Jackson's Get Back, day by day, every day, on the day. In this episode, it's a welcome return to BBC producer Nelson Kumar. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Chris? It's been a while.
It has been a while. Yeah, last time we were in the middle of a global pandemic, weren't we? I remember.
We were, yep. I was locked away in one room working all day, managed to move myself to another room to make the recording. It seems like a long time away, doesn't it? And not much has changed in the world.
Well, I was going to say. So, here we are. Get Back. What did you think of that?
Well, you know, talking about COVID just then, I think, you know, without trying to downplay it, I think the one good thing about what's happened in the last few years is that Peter Jackson had extra time to give us more of what we've got. And I mean, there's not much else you can say other than it's just brilliant. It's brilliant. And, you know, I've read reviews which said, oh, there's too much, it's too long. And I'm sure, like you and many other Beatles fans, I think there's probably not enough. I could have probably... I think you're one of the people, I think, who's been through all the Nagra tapes, the 60 hours you've heard all of them. I mean, I haven't done that, but I could definitely take more of what I saw. I mean, I was just watching back some of it just before we came to do this, and I just found myself just smiling. I just smiled at so much of it because... I never thought we'd see it. You know, you've heard over the years, you hear little snippets of stuff in the studio. And to be honest, most of it's the early years when, you know, when they're a guitar band, as it were. And you just hear things, you think, brilliant, brilliant. And then you read stories about some of the things that went on in the studio. But there it is. It's there. It's actually there. It's like they're almost not real, those four men and the ensemble around them. I love it. You know, it took me back. Especially the opening as well, took me back to 1995 and when I first saw the anthology and I first got into the Beatles, and it mad, you know, the hairs on your arms stick up and you're just like, just so excited, giddy, you know. The hardest thing was finding time to watch it all. I wanted to watch it in peace, and that was never going to happen with my kids.
It'll be there forever, which is good.
Yeah.
So let's go in. We're on day 16. And it's Saturday, 25th of January, 1969. It's the second weekend in a row that they've worked at Savile Row. And what a little treat we get. It starts off with, talking of anthology,
Derridoon,
yeah.
Brilliant.
And they're talking about India.
Yeah, I mean, the anthology was obviously when I first heard about this song in the Gardens in 95 or 96, whenever it was, with the Threetles, as it were. It's a lovely little song, and how lovely to introduce Day 16 with it. And, the footage from India as well.
Oh, man.
I mean, seeing them in Twickenham and Savile Row is great, but those shots of India, I mean, I know there was that film by Saltzman that came out with his footage. I don't even know, that might be the same footage, but it looks great, doesn't it? They look brilliant, fresh, and everything you think about the India trip is there. You see it, you know, Cynthia, Patty, Mal, they're all there, looking vibrant as well in colour.
Yeah, that bit where they're standing against the sky looks amazing.
Yeah.
And again, I love Peter Jackson's done so well here. Again, you've got Mike Love there as well. But the way he's put this together, because he's obviously got... I had audio of this, but he's got the footage of that, and he's got the original John and Paul's videos as well.
Yeah, well, that was one of the great things. Paul's just talking, saying, oh, yeah, last night I watched some footage from India, and there's you, John, with your camera. And I just thought, oh, my word, they've got this unbelievable record. You know, people have said for years that actually India is the one area which hasn't been explored enough, really, and what went on while they were there. But they've got this amazing footage, and it looked as amazing as you'd hope it would. And, I mean, Peter Jackson, I mean, he's done mind-blowing stuff here with that. I mean, it's just... It's perfect how he's moulded it together, and it's a lovely way to start day 16. In fact, as soon as I saw that, I was just like, yes, I've got a great day to work with through this footage.
Well, Peter Jackson's been talking about, or people have been asking what his next project could be. This has got to be, because John says he's got hours of audio as well. Mm. they've all got video that I reckon there's he could do something. I don't know what.
I've got this fear, you know, as brilliant as it is seeing all this footage from 69, my fear is that we might be running out and slowly we're not going to get all, but you know, that gives us hope, that does, that footage there, because it would be ridiculous if we couldn't get hold of John and Paul's footage there. I mean, do you ever think, now this might be me being a bit morbid or something, but there are some massive Beatles fans who have died over the last 15-20 years who never got to see Get Back. I mean, you would have thought in the time we are, you would have got as much as you could out of the Beatles, and here you are with just some die for footage and put the possibility of more of them in India, which would be phenomenal, wouldn't it? If you could get Saltzman's footage and then John and Paul's as well. Give Jackson everything. I mean, Jackson is now surely officially in the fifth Beatle club, I think. He could join George Martin and Epstein and Mal and Neil Aspinall and everyone else who's become a fifth member. He's a bona fide member of the fifth Beatle membership, I would say.
And I love what he does. Because John says, you know, the footage that he's got, he says, I want by John Lennon Productions written on those reels. And Peter Jackson puts it on.
Yeah. This is John Lennon Productions or John's reels or something. And I suppose to most people, they'd be like, what's going on here? But I was just chuckling when I saw it. Yeah. Peter Jackson was like, well, if you wanted it, John, you could have it. Yeah. I mean, there's not much that John didn't do in his life, you know, but now, even dead, he becomes a film producer as well.
Yeah. Then we get a bit of really weird tension. I think a lot of this stems from the meeting they had when George had quit, the second more successful one where they come to some sort of compromise. And Paul is I think the conversation must have, part of it at least, revolved around, Paul, you're overbearing, let George have his say and all this. And there's a lot of that here where you can see him pulling back and something's been said.
Yeah, you can see he's tiptoeing, isn't he? He's not wanting to upset George one bit and kind of just allowing things to be. So, you know, when they talk, you know, there was that moment where George says to him, do you regret going to India? And he says, no, you know, we should have been ourselves more. And then George just cuts the atmosphere dead, doesn't he? He says something about, but that's the whole point of us going, you know, to find out who we are, what we really were. And we can't really be who we are, being Beatles or what it was. And I'm so pleased how Paul comes out of this, in my mind anyway, because I thought that Paul, you know, had the most to lose. And I think he comes out of it brilliantly. I think everything about him's great. You know, I think he looks perfect. I love the opening when he walks on set and it's just got Paul McCartney in there. He's just swaying his hair. His beard looks brilliant. I think he talked about being overweight in that period, but I think he looks perfect. He looks great. But yeah, there was certainly some part of him that was not wanting to upset or rock George and just saying, okay, I have to keep quiet on this one, which must have been hard for him. Knowing Paul, it must have been very, very hard.
Definitely. Because I think George is a bit defensive because John and Paul are taking the mickey a bit out of Maharishi as well. They're saying about the helicopter.
He might slip you the secret.
Yeah. And he definitely looks defensive. And he's sort of saying, well, I wouldn't mind having 2 months out there, 4 months in a place like that.
Yeah.
And that's when Paul says about when he and Linda were watching the footage and he was saying about all those views, you know, in the villages and that. But we never went. We just stayed on top of the hill.
Yeah. And George gets defensive, doesn't he? He says, well, that's what we were there. I mean, it seems silly, really. They're arguing over a little thing. You know, they were there in India. We know they were there in India. But, you know, Paul was not able to say anything about the trip because George was kind of, you know, almost over his shoulder as if, what are you complaining about? Again, you know, we went to India, we wrote those songs. You know, I don't think George even likes the fact that they wrote songs, does he? But yeah, it's, I mean, the whole dynamic is basically the Beatles' life, you know, as a band, you know, from what, I don't know, 57, 58, whatever, is all played out in the hours we've got of Get Back because, you know, you can see brilliant friendship, you can see a bit of awkwardness, you can see a bit of rivalry, you can see a bit of tension, you see a bit of almost hostility, and it's all there, and it probably is a microcosm of, you know, what they went through as a band over all those years.
And it definitely highlights what people have been saying for years, you know, particularly throughout these sessions, how when they were together, that there was a bit of tension. But once the music starts, that's when it came together. They say that themselves in this.
Yeah, they do.
A few times as well. But it's so tangible here.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm sure you've talked to many people about what they thought of the Get Back films. And some people have said to me, oh, they were just four normal guys, wasn't it? There's nothing magic about it. It's just four guys who were a bit lost. And in some respects, that's true. You know, it was just, you know, guys sitting, eating toast and marmalade and having cups of tea and bickering. But also, it was absolutely magic. Every second of it was just magic. Yeah. Like things that no one else could even dream of having or owning or being a part of. It was just... I like I said, I could sit through that whole thing with just a smile on my face. Nothing was too much. Nothing was too hard to watch, too hard to listen to. It was just all great. I lapped it up, and yeah, there were some tough times that they went through, but nothing that we didn't really know about. I mean, I'm hearing a lot of this stuff for the first time. And if you look to the previous year, 68, we know there were tensions there while making the White Album. Mm. And we also know that just... 7 or 8 months after what we're watching, despite them being friendly and jokey, that it's all over. There's no comeback. And I know there were business issues that paved the way for that. But you know, you realise that relationships, friendships, even if they're as tight as the Beatles, they have these strains, and it just played out for us. And it's 50 years ago. We never got to see everything. We saw some things, but now. We have a fully a more rounded picture. And I don't know, where do you stand, Chris, with the revisionism that's now taking place? I wonder how people will now write about this period, because for decades it's been a winter of discontent. And now, with this document...
It's weird.
What do you say about it?
It's weird, isn't it? Because, as we were just saying, the arguments that they have, and somebody else mentioned this on a previous episode, how they've got the ability... I think it was Vicky who said that they've got the ability, because they're so tight... They can have a really bitchy comments at each other. And then the next minute they're joking and laughing because they are brothers. So they...
Yeah.
For those around them, it's going to seem, blimey, listen to that.
Yeah.
Just
yeah,
because... the duck's back.
Because like you said, once the music starts, they can get going. And for me, the biggest, not revelation, but the greatest thing for me was the Lennon-McCartney relationship, because... when those two are together, they make each other laugh. And, you know, there were times when they could rub each other up the wrong way. But generally, I think the two of them just had they were like brothers, essentially. And it must have been hard for George. Well, we know it was hard for all those years to sit through that relationship. And here you see it. And despite all the... You know, there were times when John looked terrible. He looked awful. You know, and but Paul knew what he had to do to keep the band going, and that was to keep John happy a lot of the time. And you know, that meant accepting Yoko to some extent, and it also meant managing another relationship with George. It must have been. I think I've got more of an appreciation of how hard it was for Paul to keep that band going, and somehow he did it. For a year or so more. But they got, you know, just a few months down the line, they were recording Abbey Road, and I know that wasn't perfect, but, you know, there was something, you know, the magic managed to carry on for one more album, which you might not have guessed would happen.
No. Talking about the relationship, I mean, there's been some things online and on podcasts and things recently about what went on in Rishikesh, because when they came back, Paul and John in particular, their relationship was not great. A few people at the time were saying that as well, noticeably. Yeah. And there are sort of comments that Yoko made in an interview where she kind of implied that John's love for Paul perhaps went in a different direction when they're in Rishikesh. Mm. And I've seen some comments about a particular moment where George asks if Paul had any regrets, and he said no. Mm. And I don't know if this is editing by Peter Jackson or if it's the actual footage, but John says, I don't regret anything ever.
Ever, yeah.
And then the only way I can describe it is he starts fellating the microphone.
He does. That's exactly what he does. I thought, I mean, okay, you carry on what you're going to say, because I found that quite, I found it funny, but... funny with a strange twist, which I think is a lot of what John Lennon provides us with.
Yeah, because I don't I'm not sure about that story about what went in Rishikesh. I don't think that would happen. Paul said too many times that it just wouldn't happen.
No.
But I think it was just John being cheeky. Very cheeky.
He's cheeky a lot in this, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Isn't it strange, you know, sort of the way it plays out, you know, some of the little bickerings and arguments that were going on. At times, you know, they've been in the middle of it. Then other times they could just ignore it. They just carry on fiddling about with their instruments, let the others get on with it. And, you know, just once there was silence, we'll just carry on. Or once someone's had their blowout or their little tantrum, we'll just carry on. And all the while you've got the solidity of Ringo just kind of like letting things go. Oh,
there's some more footage from India, including the monkeys making whoopee. And the helicopter as well. And obviously the conversation between Paul, John and George where they're saying they should have been themselves.
Yeah.
There's audio of George speaking to Ringo about that footage as well, which they didn't include. But he's basically saying, yeah, I was watching the footage and looking at Paul and Jane. They just didn't get it. They just didn't get it. And throughout all of that, Ringo doesn't say anything. So it's like, poor old Ringo. You think he must have been the one everybody moaned. You know, oh, you won't believe what someone said to me, Ringo.
Yeah.
Oh, leave me alone.
You know, I mean, it must have been... It's impossible to imagine what it was to be him. I mean, I wonder how he felt about it. Like, whether he really, like... Whether it really wound him up or whether he thought that was his role in the group and whether he knew he just had to let these things wash over, you know, because he didn't really ever seem to take a side on it or take a view. He seemed happy to go along with it, but that's I think that's got to be too easy. There must have been more to how he felt about it and the situation because, you know, he was getting ready for another project and these guys were just messing around. I mean, oh my word, procrastination. I would have gone... I couldn't have taken that. I did just how many days in a row do we hear them saying, so what are we going to do then? What's this show going to be? And I mean, poor Michael Lindsay Hogg. I mean, what a job he had. What a job he had trying to get them. I mean, I just kept thinking to myself, make a decision. So I'll make a decision. Just make a decision. They might all just go for it, but they couldn't make a decision. And I guess, actually, that's part of the charm of the whole thing, really. Just seeing they were lost, you know. I mean, if they really wanted to, they probably could have got themselves sorted. But I think they were happy just getting along, just seeing what happened next. And apart from Paul obviously wanting more to do, but you know, they were just like, well, we've got this time, let's just, I don't know. I mean, I would have found it hard to keep coming in personally, but somehow
you can see why Kevin Harrington looks so downtrodden. Oh, what am I gonna have to listen to today? Have some more tea.
Indeed.
But there's a moment where John was saying, yeah, we found out, didn't we? And George was saying, again, about India, if you were really yourselves, you wouldn't be any of who we are now.
Yeah.
And that's... There's so much of that where they openly insult each
other. Yeah, and I think, and then John goes on to, into a song after that, doesn't he? I can't really... Act naturally.
Yeah.
It's almost, okay, this one's over, act naturally. He just keeps going. And the cuts to each individual's faces are just perfect, aren't they? Because, you know, whatever you can hear in the background, the face tells you another story as well.
Yeah.
Wonderful stuff.
We discover that Billy Preston's not in today as he's doing the Lulu show.
Yeah, doing the Lulu show. Good for him. It's funny because I think a bit later on when he comes back, Paul says, did someone actually ask you to come in or we just expected you?
Yeah, again, there's no organisation. You can see Brian Epstein, what he must have had to put up with.
Well, I mean, it was just, I mean, I think they say it somewhere along the line, don't they? We just need a daddy. I think Paul says we just need a father figure who's just going to tell us what to do. I mean, that's all they needed. They probably, you know, even though they seem like they would have fought against anything, they probably just needed someone to say, right, you're doing this. And they would have done it. But, they, you know, Michael Lindsay Hogg wasn't the man to make that decision, unfortunately. And just he just had to kind of abide by their particular quirks.
Mm. And again, it's once the music starts, everything changes. Then you've got Yoko painting, Mal's taking photos, and John and Paul are doing a duet of Bye Bye Love by the Everly Brothers.
Oh, and it sounds great, doesn't it? The two, it sounds really, really good. I did like... At that point with Yoko painting and them two singing, that, I think they cut to George, and all the while I'm thinking, you know, George has been through a lot, but, you know, he sees those two just kind of just build the magic again. You know, no matter what happens, those two seem to be able to put it together. And that must have been frustrating because, you know, we also see, you know, poor George again a bit later on in that day, you know, bringing the U Blue, isn't it? Yeah. And it seems like he's fighting a lone fight. I mean, I know the others do join in and help playing, but it's him having to, you know, make all the decisions about that song. And he had a tough gig in life. Was it tough being the third Beatle? I don't know. But God, it must have taken its toll on him. Or maybe it did, you know, in later years.
Yeah. John and Paul could say the horrible things to each other, and then they just do this.
Yeah.
And John especially, he'll say something, blurt it out, and they all know him so well, and then he'll forget about it 10 minutes later. Yeah. And then he'll see, you know, George will see him and Paul singing beautiful harmonies on an Everly Brothers song.
Yeah.
And I think George had a bit more, he bore a bit more of a grudge, I think.
I mean, for all I said just about For You Blue, I'm just looking at my notes, but there is actually that point where John seems infused about one take, and he says, "Should we keep this one, George?" And then, you know, we record another, and he's up, and he's saying, "Go on, I'm feeling, I'm ready now, you know, I'm in the mood." And that must have been a frustration as well, because, you know, suddenly, okay, you're in the mood, so now we'll do everything you say. What about when I was trying to get this song sorted? But, you know, they do play, and it's quite a nice version, actually, of For You Blue. It's never been one of my favourite songs, but actually I like it when you see it being put together here.
Yeah, there's a few songs like that, I think, on here, where you see them emerge from scratch and in all that context as well.
Yeah, wow. Exactly.
And then John announces four of us on our way home, as he calls it.
Yeah.
And they're trying to work out the harmonies on two of us.
Yeah.
On the longer than the road that stretches.
Yeah.
Which seems to go on forever.
Yeah. I think when I spoke to you last time, when we did the anthology, I talked about Two of Us, how much I love that song. And, my love for it grew watching it here, because you see a lot of it for a start. But also, you know, what it was as it started. And they seemed genuinely happy while they were performing it. I think I'd always imagined the two of them were going to be sitting, you know, at the same camera, at the same mic, and, you know, having these harmonies years gone by, but actually seeing them sit opposite each other, you know, while they're singing, and singing those particular words as well, was just a beautiful, beautiful thing, I felt. And because I love it so much, I think it was really nice to see how much effort they put into that song, because it being where it is in the Beatles canon, so on start kicking off the album, the last album that was released, you just kind of had this vision that it might not have been such a happy kind of recording or a happy atmosphere, but definitely, when you see them performing it, and everyone's taking part, you know, George, Ringo, really kind of invested in it. For a song that's, I wouldn't say throwaway, but it's not something that's done much damage in their canon, you know. So, but it's really, it really is one of my favourites, and I loved seeing them take so much interest in making it and putting it together.
That's strange you say that. I remember as a kid when I got the Let It Be album, and Two of Us, same thing, even the sort of lighter songs, Two of Us especially, there was a certain heaviness around it and a darkness. And I'm convinced, well, as a kid anyway, it was just the album cover. You'd look at that and they all look so miserable. you can't imagine them even smiling when they're singing it, but they're having so much fun.
Yeah. It's so interesting what you say about the album cover, because I think the album cover and the original Let It Be documentary together were just dark. It was just dark in visually, and dark it felt in atmosphere. And the album, you know, it just had this, I mean, you listen to the Beatles themselves when they talked about it, you know, it was, it didn't seem like a joyful thing. And I don't know, I don't think that, I still think that first Let It Be film is valid, but it's good to have this counterpoint, I think, to now say, well, there was more going on, which a lot of people had always said. Anyone who had listened to the tapes always said to people, you know, it wasn't as dark and as sad and moody as it might have seemed on the album. But, you know, until I saw it, I didn't really believe it. But again, you know, I think it's too far to say everything was brilliant and joyful, because, you know, there were things that we didn't see go on, as you've alluded to, and, you know, we know there were meetings where things got a bit heated. And also we know that in 8 months' time they're going to not work together ever again, really, as a force. So it's complicated, as all relationships are. And the thing is, Chris, and this really annoys me, it winds me off, and I know I've got to get over it, we're never going to know the truth, are we? It will always be speculation. We'll never know the truth. Maharishi is not going to slip us the secret of how it really went down, because whatever anyone says now, it will just, you know, it's going to be discounted, really, isn't it?
Yeah, the best mysteries are left unsolved, though, aren't they?
How satisfying do you think it must have been for Paul to sit back and watch these films?
I think I read an article which was saying that Michael Lindsay-Hogg, when he was making this, he was working with really tense and wired 28-year-olds who were the top of their game. They had their own plans, whatever was going on. Mm. It must have been so difficult. Because when he showed them the first edit, he basically received a phone call saying the Beatles have watched your initial edit, and three of the people said, we want a lot of the John and Yoko stuff removed. So there would have been a severe editing process. So that original Lindsay-Hogg film may have been all the good bits. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah.
But from now, he's working with two guys in their 80s who are much more...
Yes.
Relaxed about that. And someone who was at the premiere said that Paul, when he was watching it, he loved it. It was like his old friends back again. It's like watching old videos of yourself and your kids, I suppose.
I can imagine. I heard a recent interview with Michael Lindsay-Hogg, actually, where he seemed very diplomatic and very kind of like he recognised what he couldn't do at the time and accepted that, you know, it's absolutely right that Jackson could do this and should do this with this footage. He says he never had any wish to do anything more with the footage himself, which I don't know if I totally believe that, but I think people have to accept that he couldn't do everything he wanted to. There's no way those guys would have allowed him at the time. And the fact that, you know, even 20, 30 years later, they were still arguing about what could go out and stuff, kind of tells you, you know, it was problematic, to say the least.
I do love the version of Two of Us when they're doing the accents.
Yeah.
You've got the French.
Yeah.
And the posh. The favourite one's the Scottish one, where they're doing the Two of Us are wearing coats on.
It's so good, isn't it? And it might have been infuriating for people there who are waiting for certain things to happen, but sitting back watching it, I couldn't get enough of that. Just seeing them, joking around. It's almost like that thing about, you know, George Martin says, you know, just their wit and their humour would have made them a big band, you know, and you get to see that.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel like, you know, you read enough stuff about Lennon to think, well, I'm not sure I would have liked to have been his friend or to have hung around him. But when you see him joking around in the studio like that, you think, oh, I'd absolutely love to be in amongst that.
Glyn makes a very good suggestion, I think. It says, why don't you get a number done, film it, do it, then move on and do another.
Yeah.
Starting that, which seems such a logical idea.
Far too logical.
And they don't. And they are. They're saying, well, and George is saying, have we got to have the album recorded by Tuesday? Because Glyn's obviously off. Glyn's actually said he's now going on Thursday.
Yeah.
And he asks everybody, what's going on? Nobody replies. George, is that it? Are we still doing a show? And nobody knows.
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, you get this far into it, day 16, and they still don't... You know, we're on a Saturday, and he's saying, do we have to have something done by Tuesday? And Glyn's thinking about going away. I mean, he concedes. He says, I won't go away till Thursday now. But what's strange is that, you know, there's a part where on this day 16 where John says, I dig to play on stage, you know. But Paul looks genuinely upset because his vision wasn't being seen at that point. But John genuinely says, I'd play on stage, and George talks about just letting it happen. You know, it's kind of the things they should have been talking about on day one and saying, do you know what, we'll just go on, we'll rehearse some songs and we'll just play on stage and do it, film it and move on. But they just got too wrapped up in it, didn't they? Because there was no direction. It allowed them to just, I suppose maybe we got some extra songs and some more things out of it because of that procrastination. But why couldn't someone have just... It's just madness going on, wasn't it? And Linda's brilliant to see Linda, because, you know, she's come over from America. She's only got to know, you know, she's only just got with Paul. So this is her first kind of, I know she was around White Album, I think. But, you know, she must have thought, is this really this band that are on top of the world. You know, seeing these guys who can't even make the decision to like of what to do day after day. Can't even turn up on time most of the time. I mean, how do you rehearse when people can't turn up on it? Just this is the biggest and best band in the world, and they can't function as a group, which, you know, is the first thing they should have been able to do.
It seems so simple in retrospect. But there's a weird bit. Paul's saying to John and Yoko, you know, when once this is all over, you're going to be off in your black bag. And
that made me
doing
laugh.
That sort of shows. But the stuff in the book that they cut out, only a few more lines, but John was saying, I would dig to play on stage. If everything was all right and there was no messing, we were just going to play on stage. And Paul's like, yeah, but it's only that. It's only that. I'd like to see Ringo playing and all that. But John goes, that's why I said yes to the TV, as in the rock and roll circus.
Yeah.
I want to do other things, but if we don't all want to do them. So he's kind of having a dig at George, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah.
That, again, might be from that meeting that they had.
Yeah. The thing, John doesn't show much kind of like anger or aggression. He does it very passively.
No.
He seems calm as if he's not worried or bothered by anything, but clearly, you know, when he says things like this, you know there's something going on. And Paul's sulking at this stage, isn't he? A bit. Because he's, you know, he's still talking about lighting a rocket going off and in the Albert Hall or having some big payoff. And I think they're past that, aren't they? They're past thinking about those kind of things. All they want to do is get something in the easiest way. They don't want to go abroad. They don't want a big audience. They just want what's going to be easy for them at this stage. It's maddening, but it also is what's brilliant about them. You know, at this stage, they were four different entities. They weren't this one beast anymore. And, you know, they couldn't work out, you know, how to please everyone. They hadn't really worked out the year before once they came back from India. You know, they were recording separately, doing their own thing to a large extent. And then 69, Twickenham was kind of like a continuation of all that, I felt. And they needed to bring, I know they had done the Isha demos and stuff, but then the studio recordings weren't as harmonious. And they should have sorted out some of these problems before they went to Twickenham. There wasn't much of a gap, was there? And clearly there were things hanging over that needed smoothing out, because the Twickenham clearly in it, and then moving on to Savile Row, just weren't the places to play these things out and on camera in front of people all the time. Yeah, that is
in limited
tough
time as well.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it?
So then we get For You Blue, and George asks Glyn how they can get the piano to sound more honky-tonk. Then George Martin steps in. He's been described a few times on here as Gandalf. He just steps in. Oh, I've put the newspaper in, chaps. And solves it immediately. And it's a lovely, as you say, I know it's not one of your favourites, but it's lovely to see Paul on the piano, John on slide, Ringo on the brushes, and George with his capo all the way up.
Yeah.
They do a few takes. John tells everybody to be quiet. They're still not happy, so they retake it. And then we see the one, and this is one of those moments where the caption comes up, this is the take that appears on Let It Be.
Isn't it amazing when you see that? It's like shivers going down. They did that perfectly. Just, you know, just putting a few words up here and there, and they were just great. It really made it. You mentioned George Martin there. Like, what was going through his mind throughout all this? I mean, not only was he seeing this band that he had in the studio, you know, who could work together and make some of the best music ever, now he's seeing them slightly older, just behaving in a way which must have, like, really frustrated him, but he always looks quite calm. I mean, surely he must have, one, been thinking, what the hell are we doing here? And two, he wasn't even in charge of the album. You know, it wasn't his album. And so there must have been a part of him thinking, I don't need a part of this. But I reckon there's also this part of him that's thinking, I'm the producer. I should be here. I'm not going to let this dissolve. And, you know, so he's there lending a hand here and there. It doesn't seem to be any tension between him and Glyn Johns at all.
No. Well, he's very keen. He's always really complimentary about Glyn. And it's in a real fatherly way. Mm. I forget which episode it is. It's one where Glyn's talking to the boys and giving them encouragement. And George kind of chips in saying, see, Glyn, yeah, he can do that. He knows what he's doing. He's a good lad. He's growing up into a fine young man. It's literally like that.
I've got to say, Glyn for me is one of the heroes of this. This accurate. He looks so cool. I mean, I think he's the same age as him. I think he's born in 42. So he, you know, he's a contemporary. He just looks cool, and he even amongst the craziness, he seems to be having a good time. And genuinely, kind of, not in the way Michael Lindsay Hogg wasn't. You know, he wanted to indulge them and let them get to where they needed to get, despite him being, you know, it must have been infuriating. But yeah, I mean, like, I don't know, if I was producing a Beatles record, I wouldn't necessarily want George Martin standing over my shoulder the whole time. But like you say, there seems to be genuine, you know, affection and want to make this as good as it can be.
Yeah. So the original plan, they were going to play at Primrose Hill in London. That's no longer possible. Here we see Michael Lindsay Hogg. He's saying, the thing is, that's lacking is a show. And this is what, as you said, John was really keen to get out there and play.
Yeah.
And again, this sums up their planning techniques. George says, well, the best things they've done have never really been planned. Oh, okay. And John says that this particular... Another moment where John is having a bit of a dig at Paul, where he says this project, which Paul considered was his number, is now everyone's number.
Yeah.
And it's genuinely uncomfortable at that moment.
Paul looks crestfallen, doesn't he? I actually felt sad for him, because there must have been so many things he wanted to say, and there's John just discussing, to all intents and purposes, Paul's project, and basically saying it's not yours anymore. And now you're not happy because it's not what you wanted to do. And it was true. It wasn't anymore. And, you know, if we didn't know how it ended at that point, you would have forgiven Paul for just saying, all right, this is done. I've done all I can do here, but it's not going to work.
Well, it's one of those, whatever he says, he gets not shouted down. But they're even talking about, because Michael Lindsay Hogg is saying, well, you know, originally it was going to be a show and a documentary. Mm. Now it's a film.
Yeah.
And Paul just sort of throws out, yeah, if we'd known that then, we could have filmed on 35mm instead of 60.
Yeah.
And then George is kind of saying, well, they can blow it up to 35mm.
Paul saying it can't be blown up, it doesn't look as good.
Yeah. And then they literally have a little argument, kind of arguing about blowing up the film. George said, well, you can blow it on a different stock. John chips in with Ektachrome 500.
I mean, the thing is, at this point, we don't trust anything they say. Like, there's nothing that you're like, no, whatever you've got. I mean, George talks about someone coming along and filming it, or someone putting it together. And, you know, you're just looking and thinking, these guys are crazy. You know, Magic Alex has built a studio that didn't work for you. You've learned no lessons. You're still talking about people coming along and doing stuff to this. And you're just like, whoa, surely enough's enough. Just leave it to the people who know what they're doing, essentially. But they couldn't, could they? They still had their right. They still wanted their way with all of it.
Yeah. And Paul, I don't know why he says this. He says, I don't know what it is I'm moaning about.
Yeah.
And he's not. They've kind of pushed him in the corner.
I think, and Glyn John says to him, nor do I know what you're moaning about. God, I mean... I can't believe I'm laughing at the fact that I'm feeling sorry for Paul. There's nothing to feel sorry for about him, because he comes out of this well, and obviously, you know, there's an agreement with the rooftop at the end, but, you know, he got some good songs out of it. I mean, you know, the probably the two most famous songs, Let It Be and Get Back. You know, he didn't do badly out of it, but he just didn't have control. And I suppose he knew the end was coming. You know, there's references to the end of it being the end once this is done. Don't think they're thinking about another album. Certainly, I don't think they talked about it, but, you know, it was just like, this performance will happen and that could be the end. And so, you know, he can, in one way, you could see, you know, he's thinking, oh, God, this is it. And look how it's ending. I haven't got control of it. No. This isn't my band, you know.
Yeah, Paul's saying, yeah, having got it together, I want to have some fun with it. He wants a big ending for the show, do a finale, go overboard.
Yeah.
And Michael Lindsay Hogg saying, well, we still could. And Paul's, no, that's just me. So, you know. And then we get I Lost My Little Girl, which is a very old song.
Yeah, there's a couple, two or three like snippets of really old recordings or things that they played in the early days, and it's, I mean, I'm guessing part of the reason why they kept playing these songs is because they weren't writing new ones, but isn't it nice to hear those performed and with, you know, with a bit of enthusiasm and stuff? And I mean, one of the big things, and I'm sure you've talked about this with people on the previous days, is how brilliant, you know, Paul in particular can just get down at the piano, just pick up the guitar, and as soon as one of them starts singing or playing a note, they all pick up almost to attention. It's like if Paul picks up a guitar and starts playing, and they all kind of like magnetically join in and start jamming together. And I think that's one of the things that really, it kind of makes you think about the old days and how brilliant it must have been when they were, you know, really on song and really you know, a group, a foursome. And yeah, you get bits of it, and you get bits like that, and you think, yeah, there is some brilliant stuff that we were very lucky, because we might not have ever seen had it not been for this.
Yeah. I love John's little line on here, because the original lyrics were, her hair didn't always curl, and John changes it to, her face didn't always curl, which I like.
There's a lot of Paul, John making up lyrics in this stuff.
Yeah. Then we get one of those, there's so many of those moments in this footage, where Michael and Glyn suggest to Paul about playing on the rooftop.
Isn't this brilliant? It's one of the best things. One of my favourite moments of the whole thing. His face, like, and Peter Jackson, I mean, he does it just brilliantly, you know, because we don't hear them say it. We see it in slow motion. Yeah. But then Glyn and Michael Lindsay Hogg have a suggestion that might give Paul the payoff he's hoping for. Yeah. And in slow motion, he's just nodding and smiling. Yeah. It's so glorious. I'm so glad it wasn't just me who felt that, because I've watched that moment so many times, and I'm so glad that you picked it out. It's just genius, isn't it? You think, set it up. Paul's moody, he's not happy, he's not getting what he wants. John's not doing what he wants. But then, you know, they realise we've got one last thing. There's one last hope for this whole thing. And it's it's so simple. We'll just go upstairs. And Paul suddenly,
not Tripoli or anywhere else.
Yes. This is it. This is it. This is what we've been playing for all these days, all these weeks. This is what we wanted. We'd just go upstairs. And then there's this crazy scene of like when they're climbing up on the roof, and I think, who's it that Paul drags?
Well, Paul and Mal are pulling Michael Lindsay Hogg up, which is a vision I'm never going to forget.
Oh, my word.
They've got an arm each.
It's not even like, come on, hell, it's just Paul's just dragging him along the floor, arms flayed, legs.
And he's still got a cigar in his mouth.
And I think Paul just leaves him once he's there. He doesn't help him up, he just walks.
He's just left flailing on the floor with his massive cigar.
You made your suggestion. I don't need anyone here. This is where we're going to play. This is it. It's the rooftop.
Yeah. You stay down there. We're going to have a little look.
But isn't it? I mean, I'm sure there was more to it, and we might not have seen it in the edit, but isn't it amazing that after all that, and it's played out so well, because, you know, when you're watching them like argue about what they're going to do still by day 16, there's a part of you, there's a sense of you, even though we know what's coming up, we know how it all ends, there's a sense of you thinking, like, how did this get resolved? How was it that someone said, we'll do the rooftop, and that they all agreed, you know, they all agreed. I mean, we know the rooftop was the ending, but why that became the thing that, yes, we'll do it. I mean, partly, I'm sure it's the fact that it's close by. We're running out of time. But it's just perfectly played out, and it seems there's almost this relief, and like, whew, they finally decided they're going up there, because I couldn't have taken it. I don't know how much more I could have taken of them saying to each other, oh, but we should do this, or we should do that, or this isn't going to work, you know. Yeah. It just...
but I think the genius vision for me will remain of Lindsay Hogg on the floor. It's lovely. And another bit where Michael shines as well, because he's telling Paul that they're going to need permission in case the cops come and throw them off.
Yeah.
Because of them. And Ringo says, well, why don't you put a camera on one of the roofs over there?
Yeah.
And Michael Lindsay's Hogg, his words are, then not only are we disturbing the peace, but we're also trespassing. And a few days later, he does exactly that. He does it.
No, but I mean, there's got to be a part of him that's just thinking, oh my God, we've got something where they're actually smiling and saying yes to, you know, at that point, you know, whether George and John were on board at that very point, he's just thinking, we'll do whatever, okay? We'll break laws, we'll trespass, I'll be undignified in climbing up onto this roof, my body sprayed across the floor, as long as we get something filmed, some performance filmed. And isn't that suddenly? It's a great ending to part two as well. I mean, the ending to part one, it might be disc one or part one, was brilliant with "Isn't It a Pity" playing George Harrison. It was great, you know. And then
it was so moving.
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, of course, you would have discussed this with one of your previous guests, but that moment is great, real kind of like, you know, shivers moment. And then, but this was in a different way, a great way to end part two and set up part three. But yeah, brilliant stuff from Peter Jackson there. Finally, something to satisfy Paul and his joyous face. They show that it's just a picture.
It really is. So just a few more little snippets. You've got me, Mr. Mustard, George pouring a glass of wine for John, Ringo putting up a music stand.
Chocolate biscuits, milk and red wine. Yeah.
The perfect combination. That was probably quite exotic for them after that toast. Dry buns.
I mean, it's one of the interesting things, actually, the glasses of wine. You know, white wine was, you know, they were drinking... you know, not a lot, but there was always alcohol around, and it was very normal, wasn't it? As normal as the tea and the toast was as their choice of beverage and food.
Yeah. And John's cross-legged on the floor.
Yeah.
And he's playing bass with the Yoko's next to him. In fact, he's lying and got his head in. Let it be.
Yeah. That is great, that let it be, though, isn't it? When he's... you know, he starts it without an intro, doesn't he? And I think George says to him, is there no intro? Is there nothing? And he almost goes, oh, all right, then. I'm sure he had it before. Okay, I'll play an intro. The intro to Let It Be is there. He is just a phenomenon, isn't he? I mean, if we didn't know before, this guy is just wild. I mean, on a different level to anyone else. I mean, if I was in his band, it would be brilliant because to see that happening, but it would also be really infuriating, I think, to have someone that good. I think I remember when you were talking to Felix White about the White album, and he talked about being in a band, and when someone comes in with something brilliant, and you kind of like, you have to kind of be happy because it's a bad song, but deep down you're thinking, how the hell? What, I mean, how do I respond to that? Or how's he come out with that? And imagine having to work really hard on your songs, and then Paul just turns up and says, oh, this is that great moment, isn't it? I can't remember, it might have been on this day or the day before, when he's at the piano and he's showing the young lad, I can't remember his name, but he's just talking to him about how you compose a song. And the guy's just sitting on the edge of the piano, smiling. You can see me thinking, this is just great. I'm getting a piano lesson by Paul McCartney. And McCartney, I don't even think it's being flash. He's just like, you know, you just keep doing this and you've got a song. Oh, my word. I reckon, had I been Michael Lindsay Hogg, I could have walked away after those sessions and written one of the greatest albums of all time just by proxy of being in the vicinity of McCartney for a month.
There's some more of their very close brotherly, niggling, biting words. Paul's saying, come on then, back to the drudgery.
Yeah.
He's joking.
Yeah,
of course. John's joking, but he still says it.
Yeah.
It's you that's bloody making it like this.
And they always... They
do that a lot.
Yes, they do it a lot. And it's that classic thing, isn't it, of passive-aggressive. And when you put on a voice to say what you want to say, because it might soften what you're saying, but deep down you want to say it with such anger and vitriol, but you put on this kind of jokey voice to say, oh, yes, you making this, but you know... Inside, they all want to burst, but they know what they've got to do, and they know each other so well that you know they can get past those kind of things. And maybe it's just accepted. If you want to have a go at me, say it in that voice, and we can get past it rather than the real truth. And
he does it again when Paul says, oh, I'm so tired, let's just reconvene tomorrow. And John's saying, yes, Paul, you have to be strict, some discipline. Get a shave, get your effing haircut, you know.
Yeah,
it's live, so, man.
It's so great, that moment, because he's playing Let It Be, and Paul, when he's on fire, is on fire. And, you know, we know about their late night sessions over the years, you know, going into studios into the early hours of the morning. And for him to be in the middle of Let It Be and go, do you know what, can we finish this tomorrow? I'm a bit tired. And the next scene, he's got his long coat on. He's on his way out of the studio. It's just brilliant. Brilliant. I mean, I've got to say, you know, if I had to pick my favourite character from this, it would be Paul, because I was surprised by a lot of it, and he just looks perfect. He just looks like the perfect human being. I remember I used to work at a television centre in London for the BBC, and I remember once I came across Richard Gere. I think he was coming on the Jonathan Ross show. And I remember walking through the donut, as it was called, this little round area, and seeing him, thinking, that guy's famous, he looks familiar, and getting close to him, and it was like he wasn't human. It was like he was just so perfectly made. He smelt brilliant. His clothes were perfect. His tan was perfect. He was just the perfect being. And I remember just thinking, I'll never see anything like this. But actually seeing Paul in a completely different way, he just seems like, because the world's there for him. Everything's there. He's had he's got a brilliant year coming up, hasn't he, in 69. I mean, he's just done Hey Jude. He's done Lady Madonna. He's going to have another single with Get Back, which he's just written in front of them as if it's, you know, a shopping list or something. He's just in the prime, you know, of life. You know, everything's there ahead of him. And man, I would have loved to have been him in those days. That would have been a thing.
Yeah. So it ends with the Beatles, basically, at this point, they plan to stage the rooftop in 4 days' time.
Yeah, that's how it ends,
isn't it? Which is amazing, yeah. But I don't know if hopefully you watched it. I'd love to talk about the closing credits.
Do you know what? I'm gonna disappoint you because I have not watched the very end of the film yet. I think I'm safe because I think I know what's going to happen. But I haven't got around to watch. Like, so many people have said to me, Nelson, what's wrong? Why is it taking you so long? And my thing was, it was just so hard to get time to watch it all. And I never wanted to watch it, like, bit by bit by bit by bit. And I've got so many dates in the diary where I think the wife and the kids are going to be away. and I think I could have this time carved out for me. And so far, it hasn't happened. But I think there's a couple of days in this month. So I will certainly be watching the end of it.
I'm going to buy you a Beatles calendar for your birthday. Right. Listen then, because you're going to love this.
Okay.
Have a look at the end. It's just after the episode we watched, the end of episode 2.
Yeah.
And it's the closing credits. And you start off, you get 4 bits of audio. The first of which is called Blues Jam. It's been given the name Blues Jam. It will blow your socks off. Billy sounds amazing. They all sound amazing. Go and have a listen. I promise you'll love it.
Okay, I will.
Then you've got The Walk, which you might have heard before, which has been doing the bootleg rounds for a while. And then Billy singing Without a Song, which is just wonderful.
I mean, we did.
And ends on Love Me Do.
Of course, why wouldn't they? Right back to the beginning. Get back to the beginning. I mean, we haven't had to discuss Billy because he wasn't really in this day, but what a character he is and how brilliant. I mean, he just slipped in as if he was like, I don't know, just this fifth member that they've had all this time who just comes in now and again and helps them. And there he is just playing amazing things on his piano and organ and it's just brilliant. I mean, I think it's the day before, isn't it? I think where they're talking about possibly making him part of the band. And Paul's not so sure, of course.
Yeah.
But he really, he could have been on that whole album, couldn't he? I know he's done it. He did a few songs, but he could have been on that whole album. It would have been great. Good move by Paul, by George, should I say, getting him in.
He changed everything, didn't he?
Mm. Yeah.
So, Nelson Kumar, pretend for a moment, it's the end of day 16, it's the end of Saturday the 25th of January, and you are Michael Lindsay Hogg. How would you be feeling at this point?
Well, I think you'd have to say slightly relieved, because somehow you might have salvaged something from the ruins, a wreckage of this film you got. You know, there's those horrible scenes where they're saying to, what would happen if we didn't, I think it's when George is gone, they say, what would happen if you just went with what you've got now? And you can see this panic on his face, like, well, we haven't got anything. And you get to this stage, day 16, and you're thinking, we're still not anywhere near where we want to be, but we have an idea for a venue. And if this can come off, we're in business. And I would be feeling, I would say, frustrated, but slightly elated that Paul was happy that we might have something to do.
Nelson Kumar, thank you so much. That was wonderful.
Thanks, Chris.